Captain Heston, side one. Go ahead.
I have divided the battle up into three phases that I thought was a logical sequence of what happened. In the first phase, it was a battle for five support bases, and it ran from the 4th to the 24th of April.
Mm-hmm.
In the second phase, the battle for the border camps, from the 5th to the 9th of May. In the third and final phase, the battle for Continental City itself, the 14th of May to the 9th of June.
Mm-hmm.
During the months of January and February, a large buildup was detected in this valley area, located southwest of Darmatil, and west of a very predominant ridge line that runs north and south along the Rocky Ridge.
Is that valley the Playtrap Valley?
No, it's not. The Playtrap is quite a bit further south, south and west.
What do you call that valley up there? Do you remember?
It was, I don't know it by a name.
Yeah.
But in that valley area, a lot of troop movements, vehicle activity, other kind of activity, indicate a buildup in the area.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the same area that the Battle of Dock Toe took place in 1968. One of the things I did is compare the Battle of 68, how we fought it with the 4th Division, 101st, and 73rd, as opposed to the way it was fought here in 72.
You say you compared the way we fought
I thought it was a very interesting comparison. Yes, I did. And that this was the area of the battle, 68, Dock Toe 68, the timing and everything. I thought there was some real interesting comparison. In fact, that was my initial interest to make a comparison and figure out what he was probably and how it developed.
What sources did you use to compare the...
I was here in 68. I flew in the battle. I flew with the 119th Assault Helicopter Company.
Is that the battle that Slam Marshall rode up in?
No. He rode in 66 in, when he talked to West Cambodia and the Fields of Bangor, I think. And several of his books, one in particular he talked about, that was one of the Medal of Honor winners. I can't remember which one it was.
He wrote about the fighting up of the Tumurong, but that was the early one, not the 68 one. Huh?
As far as I can remember, that I remember, he didn't write at the 68 battle.
Was the 68 battle the one that involved Hill 875?
875, that's correct. 875.
Where is 875?
It's located right down here. Let's see if I can find it.
The 173rd worked the Rocket Ridge area, huh?
Not initially. The 173rd was working this area to the west. They had the western part of the AO. And the 4th Division was working the ridge line south into the valley area.
Oh, the 173rd was working in the Rocket Ridge.
Negative. 4th Division.
4th Division, excuse me.
4th Division was working in that area.
Right.
And down into the valley area.
Just below it, huh?
Right.
Right.
Exactly right.
And then the 173rd was working over to the west here towards the tri-border area.
That's right. And they worked out of, what later became Ben Het, the border camp of Ben Het, which is located right up here.
Right.
They had staged out of there initially. We brought them in here out of Dock Toe, and then we CA'd them out of there into the valley area. And into the hilltops and what have you, down in the south.
Now, where was the buildup you said that took place this year? What
same
valley is it in?
Same valley, right here.
The same valley.
Right here.
It's called, Dock Roday. Yeah. The old Dock Roday. Yeah. Right near the Dock Toe Kantum border. Right near where Kantum District meets Dock Toe.
This big hill mass right here has been locally called Big Mama. It's a very, very predominant mountain.
Oh, and it took place, in other words, right to the northeast of Big Mama, the valley to the northeast of Big Mama. Okay. Right. Gotcha. Excuse me. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's fascinating. Go ahead.
It is interesting. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. So you said you compared the two battles.
Yes, I did, because I thought there was very much my own opinion. I thought there was a valid comparison in the way we conducted it as opposed to the way it was conducted here in 72.
Right.
We went out after them, so to speak. In the battle that I think they had programmed for Kantum took place in November, December, and January in this valley.
That
battle never took place in 72. The they never committed large-scale forces out here. They stayed on Forest Support Base in the ridgeline until they eventually driven off, and that, and the main encounter, the decisive battle took place around Khartoum itself. I think that was their intent back in 68. In fact, instead of 68, the 24th Regiment, I think, the NDA Regiment, did assault the city from the northeast. The same avenue approach, the main avenue approach they used this year, this time.
And you think that in 68, the NDA were trying to move into Khartoum and
were stopped. That's exactly what I think.
That's interesting.
Exactly what I think. The timing of the year in the late, in November and December, October, November, as the dry season started, they started to build up in the area. And the 4th Division countered it, moved into the area, and they fought it out. But this year, they built up in the same area, but nobody went in to get them. Until they had built up enough strength to come across.
And it's that same valley, northeast of Big Mama.
Exactly the same valley. So during the months of January and February, the buildup was monitored. The CAV, IRA CAV troop, at that time, Bravo, the 717th Air CAV squadron, was conducting reconnaissance up in the area, and the buildup was monitored, was being watched. At that time, the 22nd Division, as you already know, had elements up here involved in defensive Khartoum. They occupied fire support bases along this ridgeline known as Rocky Ridge. It's the same ridgeline where the 4th Division had its fire support bases, defense bases. They also occupied positions at Dock Toe, a little fire base out to the west of Dock Toe, called Dock Moat. Then out to the east, where they had their division forward, Tancan, the fire support base, or the compound of Tancan itself, division headquarters, forward headquarters.
And some of the same fire bases were used by the 4th.
That's right. 1338 later became Fire Support Base 5, but that was a big battle in the 4th Division, taking 1338, that predominant hill mass, just south of Dock Toe. So that it was just retained is what happened. They just stayed on it. In fact, in November of this past year, of 71, there was a pretty good sized fight at that fire support base. The enemy tried to take it.
That's right. That's fascinating. Hillmass 1338 right. Was fire support base 5.
Right.
Jesus.
So the fire support bases were strung out along this ridge line. In those places I mentioned.
Right.
As Tet approached, which is prior to Tet, and they had anticipated a large offensive up here, elements of the 2nd Airborne Brigade were moved up into the area. Mm-hmm. And they also occupied fire support bases on the southern part of the ridgeline.
You give them the same as...
No, not the same, because the 4th Division never got down that far. They didn't have fire support bases down as far as the 2nd Airborne had.
What about Fire Support Base 6, by the way? Was that ever used?
6 and 5 are right up close together. 6 is further on down. Was further on down the ridge line.
Was that ever used by the 4th, too?
Yes.
It
same
was?
Same area.
It was taken in fact, while
we
held.
Let me just look for a second here. That was back in
68. And it was also captured and held, in other words.
Oh, it was taken a long time ago. So here was 6 on 1001. That was old Colonel Belknap's fire support base. I flew in there many times back in 68 with him. He was killed out here.
Colonel Belknap?
Right, Lieutenant Colonel's battalion commander. There, at 6, 5 was 1338 right there.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, when the 4th Division assaulted in there, we assaulted them on a ridge line down here to the south, and north, basically, and then they fought their way up to the top. It was a very, very costly fight.
Mm-hmm.
So they had 6-5, and then they occupied Yankee, which was further on down, and then it was Delta, or 4-2-1, where the first ground assault took place, which I'll get into.
Now, the 4th Division did not occupy Fire Support Base Yankee.
Well, in that general area, they had fire support bases located along this whole ridge line.
And they may have had Yankee, too, but well, you know for sure they had 5 and 6.
I know 1338.
Yeah.
And I know 1001 were both fire support bases for the 4th Division in 68.
Oh, 6 is called 1001.
Well, that's kill mass, 1001.
Yeah. Okay. Did they quite have to fight for it in
68? 1338 was a real tough fight. If you read, I think you were back to some of the military publications at the time, the Battle of Dock Toe, it documents it.
Right.
But the battle for 1338 was very costly. And 1001, I don't remember a big battle involved taking that. Most of the real heavy, on the ridge line, the biggest battle that took place was for 1338 that I remember. And then the rest of the heavy fighting took place down in the valley area.
Until they got involved in 875.
That's right.
Okay.
So they had the 2nd Airborne up here and the 22nd Division. During the month of March, the fire support bases along the ridge line came under sporadic attacks by fire. Rocket and mortar fire. I think they were taking some artillery fire too. They had moved in anti-aircraft positions around the ridge line and made helicopter operations fairly hazardous. Mm-hmm. We were operating up there daily for the 22nd Division and the 2nd Airborne. However, on the 31st of March, a CH-47, the 1A Assault Support Helicopter, was shot down at Fire Support Base 421 that belonged to the Airborne. It was also known as Fire Support Base Delta. And it landed inside the fire support base, and it burned and was destroyed. However, the crew made it out alive, and with minor injuries. I think one crew member had an injured leg. Mm-hmm. For the next several days, we could not get in to get the crew out. The anti-aircraft fire and the attacks by fire on the base were so intense, it's impossible to get in there. However, on the 4th of April, Colonel Charles Bagnall, who was the 52nd Aviation Battalion commander at the time, located here in Holloway, along with, I believe it was General Ware, the deputy senior advisor, and Mr. Van, decided that they would make an all-out effort to get the crew out.
52nd Aviation Battalion.
That's right. It was here at the time.
Yeah.
They stood down in April.
Right.
So, early in the morning of the 4th, six gunships, and I believe five lift ships were launched out of here to make a first light extraction, make an attempt to pull them out. As they arrived up in the vicinity of Khartoum, they contacted the airborne headquarters and they were informed that the fire support base was under an intense ground attack. And they were requesting gunship support. Gunships immediately went out and they engaged heavy, very large enemy troop formations in the assault. The timing of their arrival was very good. And with the assistance of the gunship artillery support, they were eventually able to drive off the attack by about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, although in several cases, in fact, they got inside the perimeter and had taken a part of the compound. Gunships were firing inside the perimeter and right on the bunkers themselves. And they killed an awful lot of what was believed to be elements of the 320th NVA Division. In fact, this whole area was believed to be the attacks being made in the ridge line were believed to be elements of the 320th.
What units have taken part in the 68th battle? Do you remember the NVA units?
Second, if I remember right.
The 2nd NVA Division.
If I remember.
Any of the independent regiments from the B3 front?
Yes.
The
some of them were the same, because I remember going back to the intel reports here this time and checking the order of battle, and some of them were the same units.
You mean like 95 Bravo? Or
95 so? Bravo, and there were a couple of the others. I have to go back and check for sure. But I remember seeing them back then, and the history gives them in, as participating back in 68.
You mean the history of the battle of 68?
The history of the NVA units.
Oh, yeah.
That we know anyway, that were identified later in this area,
right,
also had them participating in 68.
Oh, you mean their own history? Yeah.
No. Our
history. Our history, right.
Our information.
Right. Okay, good.
That was the first large-scale ground attack in our area that was part of the overall countrywide offensive, the East Offensive. Mm-hmm. The next day, we were able to go in and pick up the downed crew without further incident. Significantly slackened the anti-aircraft fire in the enemy positions. Many dead, crew-served weapons, etc., were found in the vicinity of the fire support base in that morning. At any rate, for the next several weeks, all the fire support bases came under attacks, intense attacks, both ground attacks and attacks by fire, making helicopter operation, again, extremely hazardous. Although the fire support bases held up very well, and they inflicted very heavy casualties on them, they gave a real good accounting of themselves, both the 22nd troops and the 2nd Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
On the 22nd of April, Tancan came under attacks by fire. There had been reports of the 2nd NVA moving down north of Dak Tow in this general area. So the Tancan came under attacks by fire, same scenario, rockets from mortar, this type of thing, probes. I believe it was on the 23rd, they had several M41s, I think there were three. They had, if I remember right, there were four or five M41 tanks within the ground on the defense. Three of them were knocked out by surface-to-surface wire guided missiles. Probably Colonel Kaplan and Major Wiseman over that whole thing with them. At any rate, the attacks on Tancan continued. And on the 24th of April, they took their full-scale ground attack, combined arms attack, out of the northeast, north-northeast, early in the morning. And you have all the details on what happened. Now, the loss of Tancan, it wasn't too long, and they lost Dak Tow. And it wasn't too long after that that the whole defense fell back. The fire support bases were evacuated. Some of them at first started out quite orderly and some of them under pressure. However, by the time they reached the base of the mountains, many of them were ambushed.
Oh, they were? I mean,
on the east side.
You mean the guys coming off fire support bases 5 and 6 got ambushed when they got down to the bottom?
I'd have to check that for sure. I know some of them did.
Right.
Some of the Arabian troops made it out to Ben Het, where they were later picked up by CH-47s and brought into Khartoum.
Mm-hmm.
The airborne troops also withdrew from their fire support bases, and they were brought back into Khartoum.
They walked out.
That's right. Load in 2L-14 where they picked up and brought back to Khartoum. We did not use any air evacuation for fire support bases. The 22nd Division, it was determined, would not be used in the defensive contact. They had taken such heavy losses, etc. The loss of the headquarters had a tremendous effect on the Army troops, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the lessons I think we should have learned, in that the headquarters should not be in a vulnerable area. And whether or not Tancan can be considered vulnerable is a matter of opinion. And it's my opinion, yes, it was vulnerable. It wasn't prepared for an armored attack that it got. And so the loss precipitated a general withdrawal. It's interesting to note, in my opinion, that the two Ranger camps that were even further out, Ben Het and Polly Klang, were not affected by the loss of the tank camp.
Because they were...
There was no attempt to... There was no attempt to withdraw them. There was no talk of it.
Yeah.
Even though they were further extended. Whereas the fire support bases were all pulled out. So, I think that's, for my own purposes, that's enough.
Yep.
That's
a good point.
So that ended the first phase. And at that period of time, things were critical. Really critical. The defenses around Khartoum, I'm sure you got from Colonel Rotenberry, what they started to do, prepare for.
Vodin was evacuated very quickly, I gather.
Yes. It wasn't too long after that, after the initial loss, 24th April, I can't give you the exact date. Rodin was in the...
Just abandoned, in other words, just the airborne pulled out of it.
I can't tell you for sure.
Right.
I don't know for sure. The mission of defending Khartoum was given to the 23rd.
Right.
And they started moving up from Bamako. Some of them had already arrived. And preparing for the defense of Khartoum. For some reason, the enemy did not pursue his or capitalize on his initial success. It would have been something else if he'd just driven right down QL-14, but they didn't. For some reason, they turned their attention to the border camps, Polly Klang and Ben Het. And that began the second phase. On the 5th of May, Polly Klang came under intense rocket, artillery, and mortar fire. And NVA units moved in close proximity to the compound and used moved in their mini-aircraft weapons in close proximity to the compound also. So I remember there were two U.S. advisors there, and on the 6th of May, it was a decision by Mr. Van and General Hill to extract them. Mm-hmm. And they would, that was done in the evening of the 6th by a light observation helicopter from the cab, and then you pulled them out. Many of the bunkers and main bunkers and what have you within the compound were destroyed by artillery fire. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the defenders, they suffered a lot of casualties. Mm-hmm. There was quite a bit of talk with Mr. Van, General Hill, over the area. And Colonel Todd was also over the area at the time. Mm-hmm. And both those people, General Hill and Colonel Todd, could give you a lot of specifics probably about that day, 6th of May, the evacuation of the U.S. The camp held out until the 9th of May, and on the 9th of May, the Rangers evacuated the compound. They went out to the east back to Kanto. I don't believe they ever received a major ground assault, but they continued to receive very intense fire the whole time.
Did the evacuation in the U.S. lower the morale as far as you can figure out?
I don't know.
Hard to tell.
Hard to tell.
Okay.
Some of these other people I mentioned could probably tell you better than I can. They were a little closer. So we lost Holly Plant. On the 8th of May, Ben Head came under attacks by fire. Same scenario. And also large troop formations were observed to the northwest of the compound. On the 9th of May, the compound came under a full-scale ground attack. We had the airborne tow system up there at the time. I'm sure you've heard about it. We're called sign of Hawksclaw.
Right.
It successfully engaged a couple of PT-76 tanks. Mm-hmm. I believe one tank was knocked out by an Arvin with a law and negated the compound.
Mm-hmm.
Gunships were up there in support once the weather cleared, TAC air supported. And although they had a real tough time with it as far as they lost, I think that part of that burner traded hands a couple of times, they were able to hold off the attackers. And by the latter part of the day, the compound was pretty well secured, and they again had inflicted very heavy casualties on the enemy,
mm-hmm.
reportedly elements of the 320th Division.
Mm-hmm.
So that, for all intents and purposes, ended the second phase.
Mm-hmm.
They got out the next day and they found a very large body count around the compound.
Mm-hmm.
And preserved weapons again. The second phase, in my opinion, served two very important purposes for us and the Allies. One, it continued the attrition of the enemy. Attrition not only in his personnel, but in the expenditure of his ammunition to reduce these compounds. He expended quite a bit of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
So attrition. Secondly, it bought time. Time that was really needed during that period,
mm-hmm.
to prepare Khantoum for what was to come.
Mm-hmm.
Elements of the last elements of the 23rd moved into Khantoum, I believe, on the 13th of May,
mm-hmm.
the 44th Regiment, which was, I believe, considered a better regiment.
Mm-hmm.
Moved into the northwestern part of the perimeter. On the 14th of May, Khantoum received its first ground attack. It was a combined arms attack out of the northwest, several tanks, I believe the count was somewhere around 5, accompanied by infantry formations. A VNAV-01 adjusting Arvin artillery was very successful in inflicting heavy casualties on the troop formations. The airborne tow system up there was able to knock out 2 T-54 tanks. Well, it was either T-54s or 59s, I don't know.
Right.
2 medium tanks. One tank was reportedly knocked out by an Arvin with a law, one of the tanks that had penetrated the perimeter. But by mid-morning, they had stopped the attack and again inflicted pretty heavy casualties on the enemy. This was not thought to have been the main attack on the city.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was thought more in terms of a probe. Again, during this period of time, just to backtrack a little bit, Khantoum City was receiving daily attacks by fire, as I'm sure you read in the logs,
mm-hmm.
a rocket artillery fire. We were operating staging out of the Khantoum airfield, and they were being resupplied by Air Force C-130s landing there. Also, our CH-47s flying out of here were going into the soccer field up there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most key thing that we were doing as far as Army Aviation goes was the effort of our air cab troop. Bravo 717 air cab, later designated the redesignated Hotel 17. They were operating in this area of reconnaissance missions, and they were, as I said, played, in my opinion, a key role.
Mm-hmm.
In being able to monitor the buildups, the shifts in troop formations, the general activity throughout the area, to paint the picture.
Mm-hmm.
They were the key source of information, there's no doubt about it. They were able to provide up-to-date information for targeting of the arc lights, the familiar mm-hmm. arc lights, which were going in daily, very large numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They had a very high priority on contact. CAB was able to get very lucrative targets. And I think that the firepower was, in my opinion, the key mm-hmm. as far as our defense of the city.
Mm-hmm.
The ability of the Arvin to hold and the firepower were able to kill them with.
Mm-hmm.
So the CAB being able to find the targets was an essential role. We were staging, as I said, out of the Khartoum airfield at the time. We had POL points set up there and ammunition resupply, and although we were, they were mortaring and rocketing the airfield, the decision was made to continue to stand by there. It was felt so essential to have them readily available to the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we did have some aircraft damage and lost one
mm-hmm.
on the ground, just waiting. On the 21st of May, the next attack on the city, there was another one in there where tanks during the night, I think it was on the somewhere on the 15th or 16th,
mm-hmm.
rolled up just outside the perimeter and just started blasting away at the perimeter
mm-hmm.
from a distance out, but never assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
And they were engaged by airborne C-130 gunship, and also the tow aircraft went up, but he did not have any success against those at night.
He didn't. I mean, he couldn't see him, so he couldn't hit him.
Well, I don't know how much I can go into that.
I know how tired.
Specific problems.
But in any case, the system didn't work at night.
He was not able to knock out any tanks. Right.
Okay.
And I did knock any out, let's put it that way. On the 21st of May, there was a large infantry attack, thought to be regimental size from the north, directly from the north, and they were successful in making three penetrations within the compound, within the perimeter. At that time, the perimeter extended with a finger sort of that went up to L-14.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it made a penetration right at the base of that, and then there were two others further on down. However, mm-hmm. the Arvins were able to control or contain the penetrations, and late in the day, successfully counterattacked and drove them back out,
mm-hmm.
which was a good sign. As I mentioned, and I'm sure Colonel Lomberry explained how the city itself was defended, but as I understood it, that most of the 23rd was in the northern part, and then the southern portion of the city was defended mostly by RPF units.
Right.
On the 25th of May, an NBA sapper battalion infiltrated the southeast quadrant of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it was reported they were dressed in Arvin uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's been verified. At any rate, they infiltrated and occupied the southeast quadrant of the city, which effectively closed the airfield. We could no longer use it. And then on the 26th of May, the enemy launched his first large-scale main attack against the city.
Mm-hmm.
Came from the north and northeast,
mm-hmm.
and it was a combined arms attack.
Mm-hmm.
Many, or say, several tanks, I think it was 15 or something like that, 15 or 20 tanks,
mm-hmm.
and infantry formations. The airborne tow was sent out of it out from here and arrived on station about 7 in the morning by 9. And he had knocked out 9 tanks, I believe a deuce and a half, and several machine gun positions.
Mm-hmm.
It had a definite morale factor on the troops, from what I've been told. Very positive.
Knocked out 9 tanks.
The Arvin were also, pardon?
Well, what time again?
About 9 of 9.
9 tanks and 1 deuce and a half.
Plus machine gun positions.
Right.
I understand also that the Arvin, I don't know if it was on this day or several days later, that they were successful also on the ground with the law. The M-72 law.
Right.
At any rate, the 26th, they were successful in making penetrations. 53rd area up there in the north and northwest portion of the perimeter. The intense attacks continued the 27th and 28th. More tanks, more infantry, heavy artillery. It's really interesting, on the 26th, morning of the 26th, it was a very intense artillery preparation. I think it went something like from 2 to 4 in the morning, but abruptly, at one point, around 4 in the morning, it stopped. And then there was a pretty good sized delay before the attack actually began, which was interesting, I thought. Really interesting. I don't know whether it was a combo breakdown between their own people or what happened there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it was significant.
Could have run out of ammunition.
No, I don't think. I think it was a decision made that they were afraid to go keep the artillery up the tanks, so the armor was afraid that they'd get their own artillery again.
I see.
At any rate, I believe it was a mistake. Real mistake. One of the advantages of armor is it can go in under some artillery.
Right.
They didn't use it, they didn't do it. I think, in fact, it's pretty well established, even though it's my opinion too, that their coordination of armor and infantry was poor. Mm-hmm. It seemed to indicate probably they didn't have a lot of training time. Also, the use of the equipment itself seemed to be poor. They didn't seem to be real successful with a main gun. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, they weren't real successful at all with their 12.7 mounted on the top as an anti-aircraft weapon. Mm-hmm. And our gunships didn't have much of a problem from the tank itself, mm-hmm. as far as anti-aircraft weapons. But
that's interesting.
It is. They probably got the stuff in and didn't really have a lot of chance to train with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, 26th, 27th, and 28th, it went really bad. And the enemy was able to occupy the northeast quadrant of the city. So now, in effect, they had the eastern half of the city. And the situation was really bleak. Really bleak. Also, during this period of time, and I didn't even go into it, I'm sure you're aware of it, the pass down QL-14 had been closed. Surface reinforcement was out of the question. However, on the 28th and 29th, correction, on the 29th and 30th, it appeared that the enemy was not or no longer able to reinforce. I think that this is probably can be attributed to the effectiveness of the Arleigh strikes in their staging areas and on the ground over which their reinforcements would have to come. They were in very close proximity to the positions.
Mm-hmm.
These Arleigh strikes were decided on the targeting of them, what have you. It was decided on by the two corps commander, General Twan, and with Mr. Van and General Hill, in daily several meetings each day.
Mm-hmm.
And their decisions were critical, really critical. And as it turned out, very, very effective. On the 1st of June, the Vietnamese started their counterattack. RFPF units were able to work their way back in the southeast portion of the city. A lot of bitter house-to-house fighting. Gunships flew in support and attacked airstrikes in the southeast quadrant of the city. But by the 3rd of June, they pretty much secured the southeast section of the city, except for a few pockets of resistance. The defense of the NVA was very staunch. They had bunkered in the buildings, built a lot of bunkers inside the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as the Vietnamese received a lot of criticism, they did a hell of a fine job. And what I could see, and what I know, others might have been closer to it, may have a different opinion. But the fact remains, they did the dying. They did all the time to take that area back again. And
because it was ground fighting.
It was ground fighting. That's right. It was ground fighting. And it had to be done. The same with the Northeast Quadrant. After the Southeast Quadrant was taken, the 23rd Division elements of it, along with RFPF, counterattacked and worked their way back into the Northeast Quadrant. And it was real hard going again, house to house, bit of bunker to bunker type fighting. And the toll was real heavy on both sides. On the 9th of June, then Brigadier General Baugh, as I understand it, declared that the city was secured. General Baugh had been full colonel, 23rd Division commander, and was promoted by President Tu. I happened to be there that day, flying overhead. I was the Air Force. And I was flying the Air Force ship. It was a pretty dramatic scene from what I could picture was painted me over the radio. I didn't actually go on the ground. Colonel Todd didn't either, but General Hill and Mr. Van had. But the whole scene was really something.
Oh, yeah?
The artillery was going in, and the rockets were going in, and everything else. There's still fire going into the town. Plus, it was the early part of June. I think it was about the latter part of May. somewhere around the 30th of May or the 2nd of June, somewhere in there. I could find out the exact date, in fact, because I know where I can find it. The decision was made about midday, well, early in the morning, about mid-morning, that President Tu was going to go in and promote him. At least we found out about the decision in that time. And then the hustle to get the gunships in the cover. And then Colonel Todd going in to check out the area, see how it would be as far as fire goes. There's still some fire in the city, snipers and all that. And Mr. Van going in and General Tu, President Tu. And he was on the ground, I guess, about 20, 30 minutes before the motor came out. I think the 9th of June is also really significant in the fact that that was the day General Van was killed.
Right.
I was again flying that day, and I had been airborne all that day, and came back in about 1900. And we had to get a radar retirement back to the pontoon, so I had to fly back up there. And I was coming back to pass about 2100 hours. The weather was poor, really poor. And I just landed and come in here when I found out that the band was. We believe Van had crashed out in the area. Colonel Todd was also in the area. He was in the air at the time. In fact, he was going to the 23rd Division, the same place Mr. Van was going.
Well, he was going up to Compton. What was he going up for, did you
know? I think he was going up to check out the GCA. So we were using the GCA, ground patrol approach, radar, to bring the 130s in at night. Colonel Todd did an outstanding job of personally making sure that aviation-wise, they got the maximum amount of support. And a lot of times, it's the regular personal risk. Regular.
You mean physical risk?
Physical risk. Absolutely. Going in, when I told her he was going in to check out the PLO points, and on one occasion, when one of the Air Force aircraft was burning, going to get the crew out.
Is the C-130 that panicked? And
no, not that one. Colonel Anderson was involved in that one. This was another one. That was one of the wings was burning. At any rate, after the 9th of June, 23rd Elements, that ended the major fight. There were contacts. They were trying to break contact. As they moved out into the area, they ran into more of them. They started to discover how devastating the armed fights had been. Remember, I told you back in 68.
Right, the way it was conducted.
Okay, in 68, we had the firepower, we had the forces, we had the strength, we had combat power. What's combat power? Combat power is firepower and maneuver. We had them both in abundance. So we could afford, when we started building up on him, to go and get it on his ground, find him, fix him, and destroy him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we had the 4th Division, we had the 173rd, at the time we had elements of the 101st, and time even elements of the 1st Cav up here. Abundance galore. What did the Arvins have?
Mm-hmm.
Division minus, the 22nd Division? Part of an airborne unit?
Yeah.
Essentially, a whole lot less.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot less. Okay, so that type of tactic has to be out of the question.
Going out and looking for
the offense.
Yeah.
The offense, that's correct. They had to conduct the defense very defensively, capitalizing on what we had. What did we have? Combat power. We had the biggest equation, that combat power, the biggest portion of it was firepower. Not maneuver, not ground force, but firepower. And the way that that could best be used, most effectively, is just holding long enough to bring it down on it. The way it went. Khartoum was the objective. Khartoum City was the objective from the beginning. I don't think there was any doubt in anybody's mind that Khartoum was the objective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He was going to come in with X amount of force, so happened to equivalent with 3 divisions. The 320th, elements of Bravo, B-3 fight,
right.
And the 2nd. Close to 3 divisions, right?
Right.
Okay. In order to get into Khartoum City here, just looking at the city itself, and this is kind of working backwards, and it's the clarity of hindsight, right?
Mm-hmm.
The river was in the south portion of the town. At the end of the dry season, it was low. It was fordable. But it was not fordable for large troop formations, i.e. an assault.
Right.
So an avenue of approach from the southwest or the southeast has to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not logical. Not even for him. Okay, so where is he going to hit? It's got to be from somewhere in the north. The northwest portion up here, if you got a chance to look at the ground, especially the dry season, it's fairly open. Fairly open. With some low hills and what have you. But any large buildup in the area would be observable from the air. Okay? The north, directly north, it was a large hill mass. In relatively close proximity to the city again, and that's a key point. In order to hit his objective, working backwards the way he'd have to figure, he'd have to have a staging area from 3 to 5 kilometers, maybe as much as 8 kilometers, out from his objective. And by a staging area, I mean an area that he can prepare with bunkers, because his biggest threat was our air. And before he moved in his combat troops, he had to have the whole battlefield prepared. Right. And he'd have to have this bunker complex within 3 to 5 kilometers. Why? When he kicked off his attack, his troops had to march from their staging area directly into the attack.
Right.
And get there before the air, the next morning, could be on him.
Right.
So the only place you could really prepare that was in the north, and especially in the northeast. So where did he have to come from? He had to come from the northeast. The same area he came from in 68, the 24th Regiment. The northeast, north.
I mean, in Tet 68, when the 24th Regiment attacked Pontoon, they attacked from
the north northeast. That was their axis of advance. Okay, again, working backwards. If that was going to be his staging area in the north northeast part of the city, where was he coming from? All right, we already knew that the buildup was out here by the tri-border area, his natural, his habitual base area.
Yeah.
His road network.
602 or whatever.
Out here.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so if he came in this direction, all right, and the second coming down from the north, in order to get over there, he had to cross this valley area. Okay, this area, if you look at it on the ground, there's a ridge line that goes up here directly north. Then you've got this valley that follows QL-14, bordered on the east by QL-14, on the west by the ridge, and Rocket Ridge, and by the river.
Right.
This large valley area right in here. In order to get over there, he had to use that valley.
Right.
What dominated the valley?
Rocket Ridge.
Rocket Ridge. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm working outwards.
Yeah.
In order to get down there, he had to control the ridge line. From that ridge line, with 105s as they had up there, we observed and controlled the valley area. There's no way he could move trucks, which he did eventually, build roads, which he did eventually, and move large troop formations across there without observation and direct fire. No way. So he had to eliminate the ridgeline. So the defense of Khartoum started with the ridgeline, the fire support bases, and up here to the north, Dokto and Tancan. Again, in order for him to get his large troop formation, he could infiltrate troops all day long, but to supply them, to get the troop formations to really move large numbers of people, he had to control the area. So by putting, it was a tremendous economy of force move, in my opinion, in that by putting small fire support bases out there with a minimum number of troops, maximizing your advantage of, one, you have the aerial resupply by helicopter, and especially the firepower, and you control the ground. If you could get him to mass, trying to knock out these little fire support bases, and it tricked him, stop the killing process early, by the time he finally got in here, you have done a lot of the damage. That's right. You have done a lot of the damage.
Because, as you said, the hill mass, in other words, the northeast of Khartoum, to get to it, that is the ridge that runs up from the northeast, you have to cross the valley
of the
QL-14.
That's right, to the northwest. It's not even reasonable to assume that he would move all this man, material, and supply down this really treacherous, and ridiculous terrain directly north and northeast.
Yeah.
The most direct route was straight across.
Right.
Now, like I said, if he
through
could
Rocket Ridge, yeah.
So, yeah, through Rocket Ridge and then cross that valley area and then in this area. He had to have a relatively good area for the staging.
Right.
But his movement had to be across this area. Okay. So by occupying this ridge line, we denied him this. He had to knock out the ridge line. He had to knock out the fire support bases. As he had to knock out the fire support base up here at Tancan and in Dokto for his movement down. Mm-hmm. Okay. My idea is that, and the reason I'm studying this is the area, the size of the area we're talking about. To me, and I hate to use the word mobile defense, but it has the same connotations as it almost fits a description. In fact, that's the way I think it was conducted, even though it may not have been planned that way. Okay. The initial encounter was here. the idea of becoming decisive.
Pan-Can
got killed in Rocket Ridge.
Right.
That semi.
The initial encounter.
The initial encounter. The idea of becoming decisively engaged in any of those five support bases was absurd. There was no way to reinforce once they came under attack. The decision when they went up there to begin with had to be that they stayed to fight as long as they could, as much damage as possible was done to the enemy, and they fought their way out. Because there's no way of pulling them out, and there's no way of reinforcing them. Not really. Not realistically. Okay.
I mean, there's too much anti-aircraft.
Too much. And there would be. It had to be assumed that there would be when the enemy really made a determined effort to eliminate them.
Yeah.
Their purpose was to hold long enough to start the attrition. The decision had to be somewhere made, or in my opinion, even if it wasn't clear, that the decisive engagement, if the enemy really was going to take Khartoum, would not be out in this area. It couldn't be out in that area. We would have just been throwing people into a meat grinder. And by the time it was over, we'd have nothing left to hold him when he got down in Khartoum. Okay, so in that respect, they served their purpose. The one weakness in it, in my opinion, was Pancan. It was a division headquarters. It was a relatively small compound with a lot of support troops that weren't ready for battle, and it wasn't ready for an armored attack that it received. And it was not adequately defended from the north. Tanks came right down the road.
Yeah.
The loss of Tancan, the whole thing collapsed. The headquarters, the whole thing collapsed. The shock of the tanks, the whole thing collapsed. Okay. If they had been better organized and they had been able to re-grasp the situation, there was good terrain to conduct a delaying action back to Khartoum. It would have been essential if the enemy hadn't turned down to Ben Het Polyclang. In my opinion, we'd have lost Khartoum for sure, because we didn't have the delay positions, or the delay positions were not really prepared well, and if the enemy had decided to go straight for Khartoum. At any rate, in lieu of the delay positions, he went for Ben Het and Polyclang.
Have you figured out why?
The only reason I can give, and again, it's strictly conjecture on my part, Ben Het was established in 67 as a special forces camp, late 67, early 68. Polyclang also. Both of them, especially Ben Het, had been a thorn in the side of the B-3 front for years, and they've been trying to eliminate it for years. If you remember, the first time tanks were used in 68 were PT-76s against Ben Het.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And then they were used the next time up in the west of Kaesan. I can't remember the name of the compound, where they were successful.
Mangbei.
That's right. And they were successful there. So the fact that they committed tanks back in 68, to me, establishes the significance of this little puny ranger camp.
I mean, it was annoying.
It was really annoying them. That's correct. Back in 68.
Why would it annoy them so much? Simply because
it's at the mouth of the valley. Their base area is over here, and they, I think, and this is strictly opinion, I'm not of North Vietnamese, and I haven't been able to study what they've been doing. They saw it as a potential base in the rear. Okay? It was large enough with an airstrip, and the size of the compound, if they bypassed it completely, didn't make any attempt to negate it or neutralize it, there was always the possibility that we would assault, air assault in there, vertical development, get in behind them, and cut them off. The same with Polyclang.
Has they gone after Polyclang before?
They have gone after Polyclang before, but never to the extent they have for Ben Het. And the other thing is, logically, they are on good avenues of approach. It would be easy for the enemy just to drive down the road right by Ben Het, or just drive by Polyclang. So they wanted to eliminate them. So, again, it was to our advantage. This was a, these both, especially this one, is a fortress. It's built.
Yeah.
It's built to hold.
Yeah. Polyclang, of course, was small and was destroyed.
Relatively small.
Yeah.
Which brings down another good point. The size of the area. Polyclang is relatively small. Ben Het's a little bigger. Ben Het was able to absorb and hold. Polyclang was just too small. All the fire was concentrated in a very small area. One of the reasons I think Khartoum held is it's strictly its size. It was ungainly to defend because it was so large. You had to have a strung out perimeter, but that very fact offered passive defense. The artillery that they were counting in there was not as effective as it would have been if it was a small compound. It could have been concentrated. Not only that, because of this, the size, it allowed for give. Okay? It allowed for an ability to fall back without losing everything.
Yeah, it was a chessboard, in other words.
You could look at it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to what I was saying.
Right.
All right, the initial encounter was out here. Delaying positions would have been ideal, but they didn't happen. Okay? So then the next and the decisive engagement would be fought in front of contour. And there's where the key, I mean, our biggest advantage would come into play on the equation of combat power, and that is firepower. What did we have going for us when we had those arguments? Heavy, heavy arguments. Tremendous numbers of them. And available that fast, relatively. Not only that, by losing this, you can see, the enemy was oriented in this direction and in this direction. By the time we got him down to Khartoum, his whole ball of wax was here. He concentrated himself.
Yeah.
He concentrated himself. In other words, if the decision had been made for the decisive battle out here, we would have been spread too thin.
On first court base 5, yeah.
Or any of them.
Right.
He could have massed anywhere he wanted to,
right,
and chewed us up piecemeal. But by falling back to a relatively small area, you not only forced yourself into a more concentrated position, you forced him into a concentrated position,
right,
which allowed for the application of firepower. And that's precisely what happened. Then the decision was made and had to be made that Khartoum was to hold at all costs. Khartoum, the purpose of the whole idea of Khartoum was to hold it. That was his objective, that's what he wanted, and we had to deny it for the one purpose, so that it could be held in front of it to be killed. If he wanted to bypass Khartoum, he could have bypassed it. It's because he wanted it, and we were, and the Arvin were able to hold it, that we were able to kill him. If he had not massed in front of that, we never would have been able. The Arclights could have scattered all over that area and never gotten the kill power that they did when he massed in front of it.
Yeah.
So, in effect, what has happened, and again, if I look to the future as far as this whole equation of combat power, we had in the past, you can go back through history, and I'm really getting off on a tangent here, and I don't want to go that far. But look at this combat equation. Maneuver. At one time, all commanders had was troops. Who had the most troops running battle? That was strictly maneuver. Then we had firepower, we had combat. We had a little part of that combat equation. Then as time went on, technology gave us greater and greater firepower. That equation sort of middled up somewhere in the Second World War. We are now faced with a period of time where we have the introduction of atomic weapons, especially tactical nukes. I mean, if you want to go that far, but especially with heavy air and tremendous amount of ordnance we can deliver. That equation is now, the maneuver is a small part of that combat power. And it's the commander who can use the application of the firepower. And...
Yeah, because a B-52 strike is the nearest thing you have to a tactical nuclear weapon.
Well, you multiply the number of B-52 strikes that went out there, and you add up the tonnage, and I wonder how many KTs you come up with.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I don't...
I've got the figures, you know.
Okay,
yeah,
that's just, again, it's firepower. It is firepower. And that's the way it was conducted, and that's why it helped. Onlock was another example of it. Onlock, if those people in Onlock could hold long enough for them to mass around there that we could apply the firepower, he would be killed. There's no two ways about it. He would be attrited.
Yeah, see, in that sense, Kaysan was a dress rehearsal of what happened here.
Right.
Because once they massed, then it could be destroyed.
The mistake that I went back to reread the book. I went back to reread this thing to see if I could find it, and it's there. The same mistake.
Well, Bernie Paul.
Bernie Paul in Dien Bien Phu.
Yeah.
The French didn't have enough firepower. The theory was right. A place to get him to come to hold him in front of, and kill him, although it was kind of sloppy the way they went about it. But they didn't have the killing power. Especially when they got in the monsoon and lost their air.
Yeah.
It was they really lost it. They didn't have the killing power. Jupp was good. And he had the maneuver.
Right.
He had the mass of troops. And he was able to overcome the firepower the French did have, and he was successful. There was no way of overcoming it here. Or at Onlock. As long as it held.
Yeah.
As long as he didn't actually take it. Once he took it, he could go to the winds again, and we'd never catch him again.
Right. But so long as he was committed to the offense,
yeah,
and he could be fixed by the found by the fixed by the in front of the Arvin and found by the cat, he could be destroyed.
That's right. They fixed themselves.
Yeah.
instead of, if we had a lot of maneuver forces like we did in 68, we went out and fixed him and then killed him.
Yeah.
We didn't have him. The Army didn't have him. Yeah. They counted on him fixing himself. Now, again, this is my opinion, and I'm not sure that it was thought out this way.
I know it wasn't.
But that's right. The way it worked.
You know, exactly. The one person who did think of that.
I think you're right.
Not John Vann.
Oh. Who?
Colonel Bob.
Did he? Fantastic. Really fantastic.
Out of necessity.
Airborne tow, right?
Right.
As he's building up in here, moving in, we know he's got tanks. They're out there. So every day we're out looking for tanks. Maybe we find one tank. Everybody in the world goes on that one tank trying to destroy it, attack here and everything else. What it proved to me, the lesson I got out of it, is that when he's in his staging area, he's on his turf. You won't find him unless he wants to be fine. When you find him, you just find bits and pieces, and you'll have to fight over those. What you really want to wait for is wait for him to come out in the open. And there's two times he's going to come out in the open. One, when he's coming into the attack, and two, when he's running away. Either he's exploited, he's been successful, and he's continuing, and he's in the open, or he's been defeated and he's withdrawing. That's when you want to use your airborne tow system against armor. That's when you want to do the armor killing. The grunt, pick them out one at a time, wasting your time.
Oh, in other words, to go orbiting around with the tow, trying to find them ahead of time is a waste. Yeah, I see your point.
I'm thinking like in the future, or I'm thinking of the employment of the system. In my opinion, the way it might look in the future, we think in terms of now going forward. Going out and finding him for in his areas, okay, with this type of system. Yes, we want to do that, but we're not with that system. What would be better is let him come into an area you know that he doesn't know, when he's out moving in the open, on unfamiliar ground, in relatively mass, then bring that system in.
Yeah, or it can knock him out quick.
Or it can knock him out and get out of the area.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. If you go out there where he's got his anti-aircraft weapons, and he's got the ground prepared, and you're going to lose him. You're going to lose him. The only time you want to commit them is if you're in the attack and you've routed him. Yeah. You forced him to start delaying or moving back, and he's in that movement phase. Then you can go and get him. Don't get him when he's all hardened up. You're wasting your time with that system. With that system, that particular system. In my opinion. Yeah, I think that's that whole thing is fantastic.
That is interesting. Is there any other thoughts you have on that which you've helped me a great deal with your perspective about your thing?
In what respect? On the battle?
Well, your theory, yeah, on the battle or on the theory.
Or some interesting thing, I mean, some more things. All right, the enemy's preparation of battlefield. He hasn't learned his lesson, in my opinion. He uses an engineer troop, probably. He uses compressed labor. I don't know where he gets them from to build his fortifications. Mm-hmm. Before he moves his combat troops in to these staging areas, he has it prepared because of the air.
Mm-hmm.
We can watch him do that. We can watch him from the air. We can see bunkers being built. When air goes in and blows them, we can see him repairing the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
By the size of the bunker complex, we know about what size force will be in there. By the state of construction, we know about how soon it will be ready to accept troops. And when we start to see the troops infiltrating in, it gives us some idea when he's going to launch his main attack. And that's exactly the information that Cav gave, and that's the information John Paul Vann had when they knew about when the attack would come and about from where it would come. Based on that information. The Argon and the artillery, I don't think we advised them real well. They weren't hardened. We bombed, I don't know how many times, their artillery positions, trying to blow them out. They took the time to repair the artillery positions. One of the big advantages of the defense, the accrued advantage of the defense, and economy of force, and being able to prepare the terrain. He hardened. He was in the offense. He still took the time to harden his artillery. When his artillery started landing around Arvid, because of their open configuration, they weren't effective. They were forced out. In other words, we didn't harden. We should have prepared the Arvid artillery. It lost a lot of its effectiveness because it was not properly prepared.
In other words, the position should have... The same mistake the French made at the end of the pool.
Arvid
should have been dug in.
Dug in. Well prepared. Because why? Because he was coming with artillery. Because why? Because we knew he was coming with artillery.
Yeah. And you knew, relatively speaking, the fan that you would have to fire.
That's correct. Okay, and another thing was, what about the old bases, you know? When you got an armored threat, you build tank trenches. You put up defenses for an armored assault.
Right.
I didn't see any. I particularly didn't see anything around Tan Tan.
Of course, they weren't expecting the tanks to come.
No, they weren't. But around Kontumo, I think a lot more could have been done in something that should be thought of. Again, proving the advantage of the defense. You prepare the terrain. It's yours. He's going to fight on your ground. So you've got to prepare it. And I'm not sure how well it was prepared. Plus, Colonel Bond, I think, was having a heck of a time just getting everything together.
Yeah, he didn't get his regiment until 2 days before the battle.
That's correct. So it was a real big problem.
And the other guys were thinking of bugging out.
Right. Anticipation. A lot of problems occurred that could have been, that may have been, you know, the loss of resupply points, the loss of fuel well facilities, the loss of staging areas. That once the battle began, maybe somebody could have said, well, look, once the stuff stops really getting bad, we won't have this. So what will we do in place of that? Well, this would be the next likely error. Let's prepare it now, 3 days, 4 days, a week ahead of time.
What do you mean, like using fire support base 41 or 42 for refueling points or something?
Possibly, that's right.
Yeah.
Eventually, we did end up using others, additional ones. And there was, you know, some plans, but I'm thinking in terms more of the future. A lot more anticipation of what I need, what is going to happen. Same thing with the French. They're going to lose the airstrip. They're going to lose those old one spotter planes they had. So what are they going to use in lieu of it?
Yeah.
Same types of thinking for us. I think that maybe that's a good lesson to learn. Anticipation.
Yeah.
Tremendous refugee problem. When the rockets and mortars start falling, what are you going to do with the refugees? What refugees? The ones that we don't have today that we will have tomorrow, the 46,000 of them that we pulled out of there eventually.
There are about 46,000?
Somewhere around 46,000. So, you know, maybe possibly plans could have been could have started earlier. Maybe fixed-wing aircraft would have been used in low power numbers.
Are they airlifted out come soon?
By helicopter.
Most of them in VNAC and U.S.
Aircraft. That's right. Yeah.
Correct. 46,000 refugees out of Hong Kong. To play cool.
Correct.
Because the NBA closed the road at Chuba. Okay. Did you ever figure out the radius of most of the B-52 strikes? Did you ever draw a circle and get an area?
No, that has to be an interesting study. Although the only thing I'm saying is flying over the air and see the, you know, on the ground. The majority of them, as far as concentration, was in the northern part of the city, out about, oh, maybe 5 to 8 kilometers in the northeast part, right in this area right here. They're all throughout the area. But I would say that if they were any place they were concentrated, that was it.
No, majority of these twos were 5 to 6 kilometers?
5 to 8 kilometers out from the city, north and northeast, in that fan. As far as the concentration goes, again, that's just an observation on my part, and I have to believe it. You really have to check statistics to find out. But that was the ideal place for them.
Yeah.
It was the ideal place for them. And in fact, they did, I think, as you probably already found out, when they went back out in those areas, they found a lot of dead people. An awful lot of dead people. I would have loved to have been in a position to talk to Van to see how much of this he saw. I'm convinced, in my own opinion, that he saw a lot of it. That a lot of what I think happened by design. That he recognized the significance of Kontum also. That he recognized that that's where the decisive battle would be fought. And not out of the fire bases, not at Tan Tan, not at Bo Yin. That there, that's where it was going to happen. And that if the place was to be held, Kontum had a hold.
And there's if the island was to be held.
That's, you know, way above my level. Way, way above my level.
I'll find out, I hope, by the end.
I envy you for the position that you're going to be in and the people you're going to talk to.
Well, it'll be interesting to find out. But I am.
You know, this was, in my opinion, a fantastic Allied effort. And it was an absolute interdependence. We could never have done it without the Army, and the Army couldn't have done it without us. We needed the Army as a maneuver part of that equation. And they needed us in the farm.
Right.
But together, we could do it. You know, talking about going back even further, this is strictly theory.
Sure.
I think that this is the rain check. That this battle we saw here in 72 was a battle that was intended in 65. 65, when the first hardcore NBA units started moving in through Play Media.
Yeah.
And the first cab, first U.S. units met first time with NBA regulars. U.S. units against NBA. We picked up the ball. Harvin would never have been able to hold it, in my opinion.
Right.
And we held them until they faced the match in 72. Right. And I think they've proven themselves.
You mean that they can hold these people properly employed?
That's right.
That is if your tactics are used. I mean, if it's a tactic along the lines you're talking about are used in the employment of the troops.
Basically, it's a tactic of defense.
Yeah.
And the Arvin, basically in their own country, you know, are going to be, if the enemy's invading, they're going to be in the defense. And I have to, what I have to go back over, this is as I remember it.
This is 68 now.
68.
Phase one was... phase one was the build up
in the mountainous area, both of the enemy and us, in October and November.
And November. And phase two
was the Battle of Darktoe itself, which was in November, December, and January. When you had the 4th Division, the 173rd.
Right. Phase two was the Tet Offensive.
Phase three of it was the Tet Offensive, right about January and February. There wasn't a whole lot of activity out here, it was around the cities.
Right. And then phase four was the border camp.
Yes, and that was in March, up in the ranges. Well, that was another thing that I thought was real, real key about their timing, both for this and for what happened in 72.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He moves best in the dry season. He doesn't move with the guys in the wet season.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If he were to hit Contour and be successful and hold it, he would have to have the weather on his side. In other words, he'd have to have the rain season. Otherwise, if it was clear, and we could have a couple of months of clear, we could counterattack, we had air superiority the whole bit, we could get back in there and retake it. But if he took it just at the beginning of the rainy season, we'd have real difficulty getting in there. By the same token, if he lost just at the beginning of the rainy season, the rain would cover his withdrawal. Timing. November, December, January, the battle took place out here when he was building up in 68.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The Tet Offensive in Khartoum. Okay? In 72, the buildup, December, January, February.
Mm-hmm. In the rainy season.
Dry season.
Dry season.
November through May, dry season.
Right.
Build up, January, December, January, February. Mm-hmm. The actual attack, I think he was delayed by numerous airstrikes up in here in the encounters, but the actual attack, late in the dry season. If he was successful with Khartoum, he would have been hell to try and take it back in the rainy season. And being unsuccessful, he wasn't pursued. No way to pursue him. He wasn't even pursued by air.
Yeah.
He was covered for the withdrawal. Timing was great.
I see. In other words, the January-February thing is the same thing.
In other words, his build-up, his timing for his battles in this area.
Yeah, because if he took Khartoum in the Tet of 68, it's February.
February.
Rainy season starts in May.
It starts in May. May and June.
Yeah, so it would be just before the rainy season.
Well, sort of at that period of time, it would have been closer in the dry season, but more towards the middle of the dry season. But this year, it was much closer. In fact, the battle went right into June, 9th of June, which we were starting to get pretty good rains. The weather had turned pretty bad. And a lot of part of June, July. It was really bad.
That's interesting. And the first actions that took place out there were 1338, 990, and 875. Then they were fighting down in the valley.
Yeah, I'd have to go back over the sequence, but these were the major areas of contact. Initially, one of the first major ones for the 4th Division was 1338.
Mm-hmm.
For the 173rd, was out here at 875.
Mm-hmm.
Then after they took 1338 and established fire base on 1001, they had several others along the ridgeline. They went down to the valley areas, and the heavy fighting took place for the 4th Division down in the valley.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For the 173rd out here. Then later on, 990, which was west of... Benhet, southwest of Benhet. There was a big battle there, relatively. And then some of the fire support bases out here, south of Benhet, the NVA tried to knock them off the fire bases. They were attacked, but they held.
And then they went after Benhet and Pulley Plank both.
Later in that dry season, in the latter part of March and April, and then there was activity in June.
And the only unit that ever got into Khantoum was, you say, was the 24th Regiment. Of all the units that were involved in all that fighting.
NVA units that I know of. That's correct. Now, there were VC and there were sappers that got into the city. The 57th, where the assault helicopter company was located out in Khantoum Airfield at the time, was hit by sappers. Got inside the compound, did a lot of damage.
Right.
And there was an armored cav unit and an Arvin artillery unit that did very, very well. Encountering the attack on the city itself for that NVA outfit.
Probably the same compound that was hit this time.
Same compound.
18th Armored Cav or 14th Armored Cav, whatever.
Same compound. Exactly right.
I see. So your point being that if they hadn't been stopped out there, all of those units would have descended upon Khantoum.
That's my opinion. That's
and that was really their objective.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. But we had the maneuver forces to go and get them in 68.
Whereas the Vietnamese didn't this time, right. So they had to fight up in the counter forces.
That's fascinating.
That's fascinating.
In 68, we fought it.
Right.
None of the Arvin units or none of the U.S. units that fought it in 68 were still here. Right?
Right.
The B-3 front, I'd love to see their personnel structure. I'll bet you a lot of the staff and commanders that were here in 68 are here planning the same thing in 72.
Yeah, those that survived, yeah.
It stands to reason they'd use the same plan, basically.
Yeah.
But we're not the same.
Yeah.
So we didn't fight the same. Well, we didn't have to force anything. But in other words, this area was defended in 68 by different units that defended it than that defended it in 72. The experience factor was not there. But for the attackers, the experience factor was there. Basically, the B-3 front.
They knew what they were after.
Their AO. For years, their AO. Their ground. They knew what they had to do.
Yeah, and they were the controlling force in this offensive. Yeah.
They had the initiative.
Yeah. Yeah, and the B-3 front was the controlling headquarters.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, that's correct as I know it. You know.
Yeah, well, that's what I think.
Best I understand it.
That's true, that's interesting. Yeah, so they knew what they needed to do.
They knew the key terrain, they knew the terrain that had to be taken, and they knew the avenues, the best avenues approaching Khantoum. Any graduate of the base chemistry course could look at Khantoum and tell them to do a terrain analysis and tell me which way would be the most logical avenue of approach in a Khantoum for infantry, primarily infantry troops.
Yeah, and they had to get, ultimately, their infantry in a position where they could assault within a matter of hours. Yeah. Safely to the point where they could assault within a matter of hours. And the CAV did detect them building those bunker
buildings. Oh, absolutely. They detected a lot of bunker building out here, too, as staging areas, but they're very concerned about the buildup of the bunkers in the northeast quadrant.
Right.
Northeast of the city, north and northeast of the city.
Yeah, in these ridge lines.
That's right, in those ridge lines.
Yeah.
And into the north.
Yeah, I noticed that going through the sea complex. The constant reports of the building.
And then the infiltration. Pick up the strain. Pick up, if you can, the detection of the construction of the bunkers.
Yeah.
You start to pick up the extent of the bunker complex. It's by pinpointing it. Then start to pick up the movement of troops. Cab such and such, scout such and such spotted 30 men moving from north to south. Another area, 15 men moving from north to south. Moving from east to west. Coming down to the northeast. As they started to infiltrate their troops in.
Prepared. Yeah. And then, you're getting ready to the point where they make the assault.
Right.
Yeah, I heard the Arvin had using the information the CAV had plus technical intelligence, had pretty well figured out, when and where it would come to. So the CAV was the deciding factor in telling them.
CAV played a really key role.
Yeah.
Which, is a it's a sign of the future. You know, it's a lesson for the future.
Yeah.
It really is. When we're talking distances, again, you know, what are we talking? Look at the area. Do miles alone.
Right.
20, 30 miles, 40 miles in direction.
Right.
30 miles anyway, 20, 30 miles.
Right.
Pretty large
area.
Yeah,
where you've got to cover a large area.
That's right. Large area. Very large area.
First time when in 68, and just repeat this, I'll have it on the machines. Remember, the 4th Division did sets of fire bases up on the ridgelines north of Dock Pell. They C8 up there, but they didn't run into much. And this was a fire base over here.
That's right.
On the road.
Right on the road. They had an artillery fire base there, securing the bridge there.
Where QL-14 meets the river there.
Right. What's the Dock Pell?
Yeah, that's where they had another fire base.
Right, that was Manhattan. We had another fire base.
That is the 4th Division. Right? That's interesting because that's where the tank trail came from.
Right.
The tanks met right at where the QL-14 crosses the river. Jarvin thinks that's where the tanks met. One correction, the 4th Division fire base in 1968 was at Dock Moat. Not where QL. It's not QL 19. It's 512. 512 meets the river.
West
of Dock Hill. Not the place where the tank trail came in this time at QL 14 in the river. And the Arvin also had a fire base at Dock Moat this time. Thank you.